What's up and welcome to another episode of the Scott and Ian Show on the SBL podcast. Now, look, a couple episodes ago, Scott and I did one called like our signature bass is done. It was all about do they have the same weight, the same cool factor, the same panache, the same chutzpah. I don't know if I'm using that correctly or if now I'll be canceled for using that. But you know what I'm saying? Do they have the same meaning and cool factor as they used to? I don't know. There's a way I feel about it. There's a way Scott feels about it. If you haven't listened to that episode, check it out because I think it's a good time. But as we were filming that, I knew that I had this collaboration coming out with Mike Lull. Me and Spencer Lull from Mike Lull Basses in Seattle. And I just wasn't telling Scott like when it was all happening. And he had some sort of vague idea of it. But I feel like when that Signature Basses Done episode came out, then the next day on Instagram, the collab with Mike Lull dropped. And it's the IMA4, which is technically not a signature bass, although my initials are in the model number. I made this bass with Spencer as a collaboration to be something that hopefully everyone would want to check out. It's a cross between a Jazz and a Thunderbird, two of my favorite instruments of all time. But I didn't put like my hat and glasses on the back or like a signature, like an actual signature. There's nowhere where it says IMA on it or has a signature on it of any kind because I want it to be your bass, right? But Scott is not happy to see that distinction and he absolutely kicks my ass in this episode and it's really fun. So get ready for that. Also, Scott gets roasted in the studio. He breaks down what went down on his session making his Divine King project with his friend Simon King, incredible guitar player and composer. They went into the studio with a bunch of heavy cats. And I can say cats because these guys are all jazz dudes for sure. He's going to break that down, talk about what was really amazing about it and what was really difficult about it. So if you're endeavoring to make a record of your own or your own music with your band, you got to check this episode out because it's like a blueprint or at least it's a perspective of a walk through making a record. It's really very cool. So, okay, let me tell you about what's going on at SBL. So this week, mentor session coming up Monday, July 10th, we've got Ariane Kapp doing Minor Difference, Major Impact. Ooh, and a bit of funk theory or funky theory. Ariane's amazing. If you don't know, we do mentor sessions, live streams every Monday with different educators. I do it, Ariane, of course, Todd Johnson, Jacob Umansky, the list goes on, and it's amazing. It's a really awesome part of SBL. We also have Bass Space 2023. You guys, it's coming up. It's coming up July 14, 15, 16, hosted by me, hosted by Scott. Tons of people are going to be there. I can't even tell you how excited I am. It was a huge highlight of my year last year in 2022. It's back for 2023, and it's even better. So it's going to be a blast. All right, that's enough of me. Let's get into this episode, and Scott is going to absolutely let me have it for this collab signature bass that I did with Mike Lull. Let's go.
My question to you is: Spencer Lull a happy man?
we just diving in, dude.
We're going straight in, dude.
Yeah. I think he is, and so am I. To be honest, I mean,
amazing
man. It was so fun to roll out. Yeah, I've got this bass right here. I mean, it's sitting right here with me. If we're talking about that first,
let's go in. How fast did it sell out? Did he tell you?
Like almost immediately, I think within the first minute.
Oh, that's wild.
And there weren't many. I mean, there weren't many of them made. So I think there were like three? Four or five. Four. Okay. Yeah.
Shit. And seriously, and so, he sold out four or five in a minute.
Yeah.
Wow. Power of.
And so.
Power of modern day technology and all, I guess.
Yeah. Wow. Not five. Four, three or four. I can't remember if there was if I had one and then he sold the rest or what exactly it was, but it was something like that. Three or four. And the whole thing is, you know, in hindsight, we should have made double, triple, quadruple.
20.
The
20. 20. Yes. Yeah.
But we just didn't, you know, you don't want to, like I said this on Instagram, like you don't want to make 20 and then have 19 left.
you know, for like, sure. Like you step into the unknown, aren't you?
And
yeah.
You just don't know. and we didn't know, but now we know. And, you know, he has a sign up, an email sign up that if you're interested in grabbing one, you can pop over and put up on a sign up list. And
dude, on a wait list, yeah.
Listen, I was so excited about doing this project because he was into doing like a small batch thing. Yeah, Instead of releasing it, taking custom orders, and now it's 6 months and you'll get it. But like, just build them and then launch them. I mean, for me, it was inspired by what Jake does with the Grand, the Sarek Grand that he makes, where he makes a number of pieces, launches them, and then they just rip. And I think that's fun. Like, it creates an event. It creates something that everybody's getting excited about, and there's some promo around it, and it's awesome. And also, the instrument is incredible. It's really, really well done, even if I do say so myself.
Did we show people it on the last pod or not?
No. Well,
was it like all secret? I think it might have been secret, right?
No, you know what? I mean, I've taken pictures of it, and I did a little something with it, but I hadn't done like a big, you know.
But we didn't talk about it on this pod. Like, we weren't like this thing. I think that we definitely talked about how you weren't into signature bases and you weren't going to do one. And and then straight after that, launch your own signature base. I was like looking online. I was like, bullshit, Allison. But this is a fucking signature base.
Okay, like, well, hold on.
Read the serial number. IA. What does that stand for, dude?
Dude, I knew it's so funny because when Spencer and I were talking about this, he was like, let's do a signature. And I was like, let's do a collaboration. Like, I don't want to put a graphic on it. There actually isn't any of my branding on it. He really wanted to call it the IMA4. And I thought, and I was like, that's cool. I'm happy to do that.
You're a little wiggling around down there.
Oh my god, yeah.
So funny though, but awesome.
I mean, yes, I am uncomfortable with the signature base thing, but it's mostly to do with marketing, honestly. It's mostly do with like I don't want anyone to say to Spencer, scrub the decal of the stick figure of Ian off of the bass. And whatever. And there are a lot of people that have awesome signature instruments that have their name on them, or that that actually have the physical branding on it, and that's fine. But that was just the step for me that I didn't want aesthetically.
Yeah.
I wanted, like, if someone bought it, sort of akin to like the Wilcock Malarkey, for instance.
Where I
don't think it actually says Malarkey on the bass.
Yeah. You probably take the scratch plate off and there's like a naked picture of like Rob Malarkey taped to the underside of the scratch plate. If I ever do a signature series bass, right, swear to God, I'm going to get like a naked ass picture of me and stick it on the underside of every single freaking scratch plate.
Oh my God, dude. Oh, or how about this? In the run, there's all a picture of you, and all of them you're wearing pants, but in one, there's one lucky winner.
like Willy Wonka's special golden ticket, but instead of a golden ticket, you get a penis.
Oh, there it is. Sure. Yep. Yeah, you just couldn't resist. You had to actually say penis.
I had to say it. This might be the first time I've said penis on the podcast. I might just say it one more time. Penis.
Hey, you better get it out of your system. Oh, yeah, my God, dude.
Yeah, third time lucky. But, yeah, so let's talk about the bass in 1 second. But it was funny because, like, I was, you know, obviously we did that podcast. If anybody's missed the podcast, I think one of the last podcasts we released is, like, me and Ian talking about the history of signature basses, and it was a discussion about whether they're kind of like they're not as important as they used to be. I think that we were sort of like obviously very hyperbolic as always in the title. We're like, signature bass is done.
Dead.
And then are they dead? And in that, you know, and we weren't actually, it was a question and we were just having a conversation around it in that podcast. And And it was a great conversation, actually, because it's sort of like a super nerdy rabbit hole to go down. And I'm kind of sort of like a fan of like, you know, I guess sort of because of the era that Ian and I grew up on, in signature basses were a whole thing back then. We were questioning whether they are still as important as they were, if there's still room for them. And we also talked about, Ian shared his fear about having like his signature on the top of a signature bass and stuff like that. And then we also talked about Federa basses and how they were doing signature basses that were definitely a little bit more akin to what Mike Lull's done. Not Mike Lull, sorry, Spencer Lull with this bass, where there's Ian's signature is not on the bass and there's absolutely no naked pictures of him inside any sort of like cavity on the bass.
Into the control cavity.
So definitely check that episode out if you haven't already, because it'll give like a little bit more context around this, and it is an interesting topic. But the reason why I was ribbing Ian there is because in that episode he was like, "Yeah, I don't really want to do a signature bass," and then like literally a couple of weeks later, I was like looking on Instagram. I'm like, "Yep, this is definitely a signature bass."
I knew about this. So my hope was that it would be, the positioning would be more of like collaboration. But I think that went down the drain when I agreed to call it the IMA4. I think if it wasn't called that, right, and it didn't have my initials in the title of the bass, like in the model, I think then it could potentially have been seen as more of like okay, Ian's involved in this, he helped design it, but it's not a signature thing.
I'm into the signature thing. I'm glad that you've got your initials on there. Like, just saying, like, I'm a, you know, child of the 80s and 90s, and I love the kind of that signature bass, in that I think that it's cool. And in that past episode I did say that, you know, when you get that signature bass, the one side of it is that it erodes that, like, finding your own sound, because you are essentially a tribute to somebody else's sound. Yes,
I know.
But on the flip side of that, I also think it's awesome to pay tribute to other people's sounds. And there were plenty of, like, for instance, I was watching Tim LaFave this morning on YouTube, sitting in my local coffee shop having a lovely breakfast and flat white. Oh, it was delicious. Gosh. And I was sitting there, flat I was white. Actually listening to outrageous sort of like improvisational mayhem with Chris Potter on sax and Tim LaFave on his cool Wilcock Malarkey, which is the Rob Malarkey signature Wilcock bass, and Tim was playing it. So I think it still works. I think it all works. I think it's great.
I think it works too. And I think I will say this. This was, I have like a real excitement for design. And I'm not just thinking, like, if I was like, oh, how do I make this the perfect bass just for me? It would be different. There would be things about it that I would have changed, but it's not just a bass for me. I mean, like, for instance, it has a 12-inch radius, so it has like a flat radius. I like a more vintage radius. Now, that said, I've gotten used to it and it's really cool, but like, if I were
you would have maybe gone with a rounder radius.
Yes, but Lull likes to do, I think it's 12. Just for playability, for the pleck, for evenness. And I was like, great. I think that's a better call for this instrument anyway. I maybe would have done a pick guard had it been mine, but we sort of just went for it. And I was not just thinking like, oh, what is going to be the thing that is just going to suit me? But I wanted to make something that actually, like, Daryl Anders from Dunlop called me yesterday and he was like,
he was a lovely man.
I would never, Daryl is amazing. He was like, I would never want this bass. Why do I want this bass? And I was like, yeah, dude, I know. Yeah, okay. Because it's kind of weird and rock and roll, right? The whole thing is painted. I don't know that I would have done this necessarily had it been like, okay, you can spec every single thing out. But I was like, oh, it's gonna be cohesive. Like, the aesthetic is going to be really cool. I love the big oversized reversed headstock. I love that they do that and have that as an option, but this is only available on the IMA4. We're not custom ordering that. You know, like, I helped Spencer build this as a product. Like, I maybe would have put blocks on the neck, But I was like, I think it would look really cool. Like, if it doesn't have a pick guard, it would look really cool to have, you know,
lavender blocks.
Yeah, that'd be sweet. But I thought it was just like simple and beautiful, totally naked.
IMA 4.2.
Yeah, dude. Well, listen, there's not to say that there won't be potentially a different iteration coming. I mean, they sold out so fast, and they're not cheap either. I think they sold for $54.99. So,
you know what I'd do if I was Spencer Lull right now?
What's that?
Just to put it out. The obvious... And then the problem is, I guess, that sort of like physical businesses are a lot more complex than digital businesses. So
yeah.
I'm putting that there as a caveat, but he could explode Lull by firstly doing another run with you. So but doing it sort of like a bigger run, like 10 bases. Let's say 10 sure. bases or something like that. Great.
Yep.
Okay. But my point is that all of these bases were actually primarily sold off you.
Sure.
Right? It was you. The reason they bought them is because of you. So if then Spencer just goes and partners with 3 to 5 or more yous and runs that same strategy, he's not... It's a very targeted audience, so... Yeah, like that would be really interesting.
Oh, for sure.
To look at.
Do you know what I want to see, Amos Heller? If you're listening, I want to see the AH4. Like, I want to see the four.
Is Amos so with bad.
Hull? No, he's not. But he should be.
There you go.
I mean, I think, you know, if anyone at Fender is listening, I mean, Fender should snap up Amos. He plays Fenders with Taylor. And to me, that is a no freaking brainer. He should have a custom shop model. I think he's also done some stuff with Yamaha. But anyway, Amos, I just love you. And it'd be amazing to see like a really sick signature that you spec out. I don't know, man. I agree. What about this, Scott? Here's where I thought you were going with that. When you said he should partner with other people and do runs like that, I completely agree. But also, do you think he should scale with... Okay, let me ask you this. A small business, 8 employees, all U.S. made. What's the point at which, or does a business like that scale to... Korean factory or Chinese factory, where now you're making instruments that are sub $2,000, sub $1,000, and open the market that way? Do you do that, or does that cheapen the brand?
I'm not sure. Like, well, Dingwall have done a great job of it. There are various. Yeah, Dingwall did a great job of it. But I would say the interesting thing that at least that I've experienced is that there's a bunch of people tried to do it and not done it great.
Oh, yeah, okay. Do you feel like you can say who? You don't have to.
No, not really. I don't want to sort of like put it out there. But yeah, but like, you know, just everybody listening to this pod, right? Think about it. Like, how many American sort of like custom makers have done that? They've partnered with somebody in the Far East. They've started doing sort of like bases that are sub $2,000 in
budget
sort
version.
Of like budget version and stuff like that, and I just fucking hate them bases. Like, for the most part, I've not actually played. Sadowski have done a cool job of it. There is a handful of people that have made it work. Sadowski's done a good job of it.
Yeah, you know, I also think of the Euros that Spectre makes are really good. The Euro line that they make, I really like a lot. I think they've done a really good job of it. They've been doing it a long time too.
But
I can think of a few that I'm like, oh yeah, it's kind of a bummer. But I mean,
I think there is expansion in the US basically. If I was in Spencer's shoes, I'd probably try and big fat caveat, I know nothing about this in terms of Like, even though sort of like I was a luthier when I was a kid, like an apprentice luthier, I didn't really get into the economics of the business or anything. Like, I was freaking sanding bases, dude.
Yeah, dude, so, all day.
All effing day. So, so I don't really know enough about the economics of it. It'd be great to have a conversation with, you know, dudes like Dingwall and stuff like that to sort of like, you know, to ask those questions. But if I was in Spencer's shoes, I would be asking, how much juice can I get from the squeeze that I've got right now?
Yes.
And then when that's maxed out, then look at, okay, you know, can we
then move?
Is there another move, right? Because I think that the big fat distraction would be, oh yeah, let's go and try and do these in the Far East when you haven't even got all of the juice from the squeeze that you've got right now. The orange is half squeezed and you're freaking looking somewhere else, you know.
You're gonna squeeze another orange. Squeeze the orange you got.
Squeeze the orange you've got, yeah. Like how many bases? Yeah. Like obviously you'd have to expand the team that he's got already. He would have to partner with other individuals like you. He would probably have to have sort of like a brand manager. I mean, sort of like a partnership manager on staff who sort of like really managed those partnerships, like between you,
for sure.
like with people like you, because he can't do all of that. Imagine if you times five. That's too much work. And
it's a lot of emails or texts.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But I think that this is also sort of like a great, representation of what can be done for other base manufacturers as well. Looking at what you know, like people are sleeping on this. You know, some people aren't.
No,
yeah,
big time. And you know, the idea for it came from Jake Sarek, but Jake wasn't doing it with anybody. Jake was just doing the runs himself.
Yeah,
but it also came from Shoe World, Watch World. And my dad has talked about this in Gun World, where with like a gun manufacturer will partner with someone, or they'll do these limited releases. Knives, too. They're like knife makers that partner and do these cool drops. And I was like, why isn't anyone doing this in our space?
Federa did it way back when. They did, like Matt Garrison, they did a run of 20 Matt Garrison standards, like back in the day. Okay. They used to batch them. Who else? Cool. Has Dingwall done anything like this?
Yes, they just did the Rio base, the John Taylor Duran Duran base.
Was there a limited number?
Yes, and they're gone.
Yeah,
And to me, it's fun. To me, there's something fun about building them, I say that. You know, it's funny because it's like Spencer is on the, you know, he buys the stuff to build them. So he's like financially on the hook. I'm like, just fun to build a bunch of them. But I'm you know, caveat is I'm not taking on any of that responsibility. But as a consumer, it's so fun to see a drop of things. Because it creates that excitement, the scarcity, right? The excitement, you have to get it now. That it's a good time. I enjoy that. And then, you know, you get input on what do you want to see the next time?
Just one thing to add, and then let's just take people through the base, because I know that we're nerding out on the business side of it. But just if I was like somebody like, let's say in Spencer, and I do apologize, Spencer, if you're listening to this and you're like, yeah, cheers for all of the unsolicited advice, Mr. Divine. Thank you for all of that crap. So take this with a pinch of salt. But I'm kind of nerdy about this stuff. So what I would be thinking about is, okay, like, because you couldn't do one a month. Let's say that manufacture is not a bottleneck, right? Let's just move that off the table, right?
Yeah.
Just think about sales rather than manufacture. So if we're thinking just about the manufacturer side, like you couldn't do one a month. So it's going to be, because that would just be too crazy, and your audience would be like, oh, these guys are just doing drops with everybody. It's just, it'd feel a bit kind of just like rinse and repeat, maybe.
Yes, sure.
So let's hypothetically say that a good kind of like number to start with might be six drops a year. So doing it every two months. Yeah, it gives you enough time to kind of stir up some noise about it, tell the story, get the social media sort of like stirring and happening and stuff like that. So maybe you're looking, and maybe the to keep the sales pumping as well, so people are really kind of hungry for it, maybe you only do one drop per artist per year. Mm-hmm. So there's only one IA for what was it?
IMA. Ian Martin IMA. Allison. Baby.
Oh yeah, IMA, right? Maybe there's only one drop of that bass per year.
Yeah.
And maybe maybe there's only 10 a year. But then if you partner with five other people, so if you've got six artists and they're all highly, I think that the they would have to be like you, sort of like they would have to have a following. That following has to be super engaged. They have to be very committed to sort of like building that following and telling the story of the bass and all of that.
Sure.
But if you could get six of yous, that and you could do a drop of 10 once a year, that's potentially 60 extra basses per year that you can build on top of your usual inventory, and the usual inventory is going to go up as well because of the marketing and the sort of like halo effect of all of the other bases. So let's say you get 60 extra bases through the drops, and then the halo effect brings up like 20 or 30% of your regular sales. Suddenly, you might be doing double the amount of bases that you're originally selling.
Definitely. And what Spencer has even seen so far is people, you know, okay, you didn't get one of these. Ah, but I guess I didn't really want the reverse headstock anyway. So let me put in a custom order that has these pickups that's a P-bass shape. Or, like, that's what's going to happen, you know? And I think that's amazing. Yeah. I think it's awesome. Let me just go back and just say one thing. I don't want to just let this sit and then feel like, you said, oh, you know, he sold these off the back of you. While I do think that I helped, I also think that, like, if the instrument would have been not so well put together and designed and, like, I don't think I could sell just anything, personally.
Oh, yeah, you couldn't sell, like, a piece of shit, but... Right. I think that what I meant by, you're absolutely right for pulling me on that. So what I meant by you sold this is sort of like it's their kind of like legacy, awesome craftsmanship base building. It's this partnered with you.
Yes. Like, yes.
That's what makes the
you get like it, the, it yeah. gets an extra spark because of the partnership. Like it's if they would have just done a run,
yes. equals six. It's that. Do you know what I mean? It's plus one equals six, not one plus one equals two.
And I do agree with that because it's you also get double the promo,
right? You're a sexy bassman.
Yeah, you get damn right. you get two pages promoting it too. You know, you just get double the promotion. And so I totally agree with you. I hope Spencer and other people do. I hope this becomes well. And again, something else I want to say is if I talk about this like, oh, no one else is doing this, and I feel like I've said some stupid crap in this episode already, and then you're like, well, with the, you know, the Matt Garrison, like, I think maybe a little bit blind to some offerings that have come before, and I'm probably giving Jake Sarek the credit for something that has happened a lot in the past that I just don't quite know about. I didn't know about the Matt Garrison.
It was a long time ago. Yeah, like when they started doing the Matt, it was they were called the MG Standard, Matt Garrison Standard, where it was sort of like a slightly cheaper, more affordable version. So instead of like giving up both of your kidneys, you only had to give up sort of like one and a half. So you didn't completely die after paying for it, but you could sort of like hang on your life. Could like hang on by a small thread as you played that.
Bleeding out.
I jest. I love Federer's. But my point is that they did do, but it was way back in the day. But I think that it's interesting. I think that, I think that it'd be interesting to see somebody really lean into that model. Like, really, like, just embrace it and be like, okay, we're going to create like a, do you know, like Ibanez back in the day, they were fucking unstoppable. They had Steve Vai, had Joe Satriani, they had Red Beach, they had Pat Metheny, they had like, do you know,
Frank Gambale,
right? They had this sort of like awesome collection of artists who were just like, it was freaking, they just really leaned in. They were just like,
they really did.
We're going hard, Gary Willis is the first Ibanez signature bass artist. He was the
first.
Was
that right?
He was right. Crazy. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Wow. Wow, that's cool. Yeah, Ibanez has Tim Henson now too from Polyphia. I mean, you know, I wonder if they do. They probably do some kind of batchy stuff, and I'm sure, you know, and I know, you know, like Paul Reed Smith, I'm sure does like, you know, small number of like a super select, you know, like, oh, you can get the first 10 of the John Mayer Silver Sky that's going to be in this color, and then we're going to, you know, not have it anymore. But yeah, man, I think that maybe in bass world it just isn't as, it isn't as much of a thing, but I hope it becomes more of a thing because it's fun. It's just fun to be a part of. It's fun to see. I think it's awesome.
And kudos to you, mate, because like I watch them videos, and you are so fucking talented at. You are just like, yeah, you're just really, really talented at positioning stuff and like, and it just, and making stuff look awesome. You are like, you are. You bring the awesome. You are awesome, but you make things look awesome. You just sort of like, you bring that sort of like, you know, just sort of like energy to it. And it was, yeah, it was really inspiring, actually. Thank I was you, like, dude. Damn. I was like, I love that signature bass, Ian.
God damn it. I'm never going to live it down.
Oh. Never.
No, dude, it's a collab. You're like, yeah, okay, okay, okay.
But it was, yeah, it's awesome, dude. It's awesome. Quick rundown of the bass. Give us the, if anybody is listening to this, obviously you can go to the YouTube channel and subscribe over there and stuff like that. Like the podcast YouTube channel. We've got a specific podcast YouTube channel. You go and see some pictures on there, but it's beautiful. Give people a rundown of it.
Well, it's Fire Mist Lavender. That's a color that that I got to name, which is really fun. And I like this color very much. It's, you know, sort of like a light purple, but it has some sparkle. The whole thing is painted, so the neck, so matching headstock, but even the back of the headstock is painted. It has a slab ebony fingerboard with nothing on the face, and has big lumen lay side dots that are so amazing. It's dad font, slightly bigger, nice. You know, slightly bigger. It's good. Also, the body is amazing. It's a full-size jazz bass, and it is solid swamp ash. It's not chambered. Typically they chamber because weight, because ash is so heavy, but they sourced this super expensive, amazing, lightweight swamp ash. So the whole instrument weighs 8.5 pounds, which is unusual. Like if you're thinking Fenders from the 70s are 10 pounds plus, this is 8.5, even with this big headstock, and even with a full-size non-chambered jazz body. So that's cool. Hipshot B, which has become like maybe my new favorite bridge ever. It's so good. It's
is
so
that
solid.
What I've got on this?
I don't know.
Let's have a
show
look.
Me. Is
can
that,
you see I, that?
Oh yeah, hello? Yes, yes. That's a B. Yeah.
Is that a B?
Yes.
Yeah, I love it.
I think it's amazing. I have some basses that have hipshot A's, but those were the strings sort of sit down in a little groove, and then you can't really palm mute very well.
Yeah.
And they're beautiful and they're really
the high
functional.
Mass, the A's they're are high, higher, the heavier. Yeah. Aren't they? Yeah.
But
yeah.
This to me is a. I love it. I love this bridge. I did P bass knobs because I think they're the best knobs ever. Those big, knurled, flat top P bass knobs.
Yeah.
We did. And then the pickups are really special. Briefly, pickups were reverse engineered from Mike Lull's personal 64, I believe, T Bird. And they're expensive, and they're hard to make, and they don't sell them separately, so you have to get them in a Lull, or someone buys a Lull and pulls them out. I've seen people do that before, too. And they're incredible. I'll show you how it sounds in a sec. And then you have this overhang. It's kind of cool, a little bit of overhang here, 21 frets into the truss rod. And then, oversized reverse headstock. They first made this headstock ages ago for Jeff Ament from Pearl Jam.
Yes.
But different logo, and you know, Brandon Campbell from Neon Trees played basses with this headstock too, but they haven't done it in a while. And I mean, obviously, I think they're still building it for Jeff, or I think they would. But it's not offered as like a standard. You can't go on and order a bass with this headstock. It's like an artist headstock, right? And I love that it's huge. It's huge. It's giant. Like, you know, it sits.
You can do damage with it, right?
Yeah, you could. It's like a spear, dude. Hip shot. And here's one other thing, quick. It's volume, tone. But the first bass came with 500K audio taper pots, and I loved it, but it felt like it could just be a tiny bit more open. So we went to 1 meg pots, which is really unusual. 1 meg pots let a little more high-end pass, and they're linear taper so that you can actually blend the pickups. You know how, like, on a jazz bass, if you turn a knob a little bit, it just snaps to the pickup? This one has a little bit more. A little more blendability, which I think is really cool, and it just makes the whole bass subtly, naturally brighter. Humbuckers, it makes no noise.
Beautiful.
Fully passive. Freaking amazing. Maple neck, graphite reinforced. Yeah, it's like all the best stuff that they do, I think, in a bass.
It's awesome, isn't it? Yeah. And what's the difference between sort of like, let's talk about just briefly, like, you know, like the jazz bass luthiers. I'm thinking like Lull, Sadowski,
Aleva.
Alinto. Is there anybody else? Alinto, Sadowski, Lull.
I mean, Lakeland makes their own jazz bass.
Yeah, Lakeland, yeah. Like, where does Lull sit in the mix of all of that?
I think they're a little under the radar. I think that people, you know, it's interesting. Like, when I talk about them, I feel like people have heard of Sadowski, but far fewer people have heard of Lull. Started out as a repair shop. Mike was a bass player, started to make his own instruments. I think they're kind of a sleeper. I think they make an amazing bass that isn't, to me, just like a straight Fender clone. There are those Fender clones out there. Like, you know, I feel like, you know, Nash, Bluesman, Vintage, there's stuff where they really are trying to make a Fender. But this isn't quite that. The body shape is a little different. They do a different thing with the neck heel. They do just a different thing with shielding. Everything is completely shielded and, like, totally noise-free. Obviously, the shape of the headstock's different. The neck, too. I mean, this is so nerdy and specced out, but check this out. This neck is 1.55, so slightly wider than a jazz.
Oh, slightly wider.
But not as wide as a P. And then 0.84 depth, so a little bit chunkier than maybe a typical jazz bass. So it's like kind of halfway between a P and a J neck, which I think is so cool.
And is that specific to that bass or all Lull jazzes?
I think this one has a slightly wider. I think you can get them 1.5. Spencer, if you listen, I'm sorry if I screw this up. But I think there are a few options for neck profile. So this one is sort of special in that way. But the curvature, too, the way they do their C is different. They're not trying to do, they're not trying to just make a Fender. The way they roll, the way they put frets in is a little different as well.
Okay.
And to me, it's just, it looks like, if you see it, especially if it doesn't have this pickups in it, if you see a bass like this, you're like, oh, it's just a jazz bass copy. But under the hood, there's differences about it. You use flats on maple for the necks, but then graphite reinforce. I'm sure a lot of companies do that, but that's not a Fender thing. So to me, it's not screaming, I'm the same as a Fender, but better. And it's also not screaming, look at my 10 top, you know, bird's eye maple. It's not that either. It's sort of like kind of understated, but a lot of cool, what I think are like improvements, just small things that make it really a treat to play.
Yeah. I love it, man. I love it.
Thanks. I love it too.
Glad we did it.
Do you want to just hear it real quick? Let me show you. Yeah. Let me just show you. I have it plugged in, so you can just hear the pickups. So, you know, I think, to me, it's both pickups on. It sounds sort of jazz bassy.
I really love those pickups, man. I really love them. Yeah.
But then if you solo the neck, it's so cool.
Brilliant.
Then bridge is snarly, but it still has all this low end. Yeah, it's awesome. slaps great. But it doesn't sound just like a jazz bass. Like it's it's like more almost more mid forward.
Yeah, no. It isn't as mid scooped as a jazz.
Not at all, right? But still fun to slap. But the neck pickup to me, it's really cool. It's so mean.
Cool, interesting, like mid vibe to the sound, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. Yeah. And if you play it on a gig, it just like it just smashes. It just it like sits because it's got all this low end, but then it has all this like horsepower. Last thing is, I think the top end of it for like for this kind of stuff that I do, I really like the sound of the pickups in this vibe.
Yeah,
I love it, man. I mean, I'm thrilled. Oh God! And
next year, people, you can get one.
Yeah,
I'm sure that you're going to do a run soon. But yeah, love it, man.
We're already talking about what the next run's going to be. If anybody out there wants to have some input around colors or, you know, potential features, a lot of people asked for a five. So you know, who knows.
Oh, you should definitely do a five, dude. You should definitely do a five.
Be cool, right?
Yeah, I think it'd be cool.
Hey,
what else, what's on the docket?
What's on the docket? You have recently been in the studio.
Yeah, I survived.
You did a record, dude.
Oh, I did
a freaking record.
God, oh, boy.
I feel embarrassed that we talked about that bass for that long. Let's talk about your record. We've been building up to this for a long time. You've been shedding so long. We've talked about Excalibur, the types of basses you wanted to use. Before we talk about the studio experience, please let me know and let the people know, what did you decide to play on this record and why?
I play
the banana bass.
But the banana bass.
If no one is seeing it.
Yeah, dude, I play
those strings
this
are
one.
Dead.
Oh, dude,
those
you have
strings
no
are
idea.
Dead.
I know. I should have. I actually left them on. They're just because. And this is like.
Oh, I bet it was cool.
These are the ones we recorded with. They were new when I went in the studio, and then when I went out, when I left the studio, they were not new anymore.
They were old.
Yeah, they were old as well. Yeah, so the tone like deteriorates or changes throughout the album. But yeah, I actually, after all of the freaking pissing around I did,
I
ended up using this. And for a couple of different reasons, when it got to it, when it was coming up to the weekend, so we started recording on a Monday, I was sort of like shedding. My hands started to flip out a little bit on the Friday.
Oh,
I was having some sort of like weird, so if anybody watches the videos when we play, because we recorded, we filmed all of the album being recorded as well, I have to wear both. I've got both gloves on, full mittens.
full mittens, yes.
I'm full mittened up on it. So it started going a little weird on the Friday before we got in the studio. And something that does sometimes set it off is jumping between basses. And even though they're both F basses and both, you know, really similar in terms of the... in terms of the geometry and the feel of the basses.
You're talking about that one and the fretless.
And the
right?
fretless. It made me super paranoid. I was like, oh, am I gonna screw this up? Am I gonna set my hands off and my vocal dystonia is just gonna explode?
Yeah.
So when it got to the Friday, I was sort of like, I was just thinking, I might just do this on the Friday. And if anybody's wondering why this is sort of like controversial, it's because I was gonna do the entire thing on a fretless, the entire thing. And I went down a whole rabbit hole of getting a fretless and getting lines put in it, and there was the little Willis jokes that we were joking about. Even freaking Gary Willis was emailing me. Even Willis was in on it.
He was in on it, dude. He was in on it.
It was hilarious.
Oh
yeah.
My God.
So,
also, there was just a piece of content that went out on SBL from the podcast of you being like, isn't it interesting if you commit commit to one instrument. Dude, I wanted to rib you about this. You're like, you commit to one instrument. You know, I mean, sometimes bouncing around, you know, you don't really get that thing of when it's an extension of you. And you say, it's like the thing I have with the black fretless. It's become an extension of me.
And then I ended up on the freaking banana bites.
Oh, it's great. But, dude, I get it. I was thinking, Jesus, man, to play that music, it's not easy music to play. You're not playing a lot of whole notes. You know what I mean?
There was more complexity to it as well. So I think that was part of why I ended up playing it all on fretted. Another part of it was that it was... weird. Somebody's calling me from... where I used to live.
Oh,
like weird. I haven't been there for 10 years.
Maybe weird. An ex.
Okay.
Trying to get back in touch.
I'm just like, you know, when somebody calls in the middle of the night, you're like, who's that? Who's dead? Somebody's bad. I know.
Versus when you were younger, dude, your friends would call you in the middle of the night to like talk shit. And that was amazing. But now you're an adult. Someone calls you in the middle of the night. You're like, you get that panic.
Like something bad's happened somewhere. I'll see if they'll leave a message. Anyway, so there was more complexity to it. So there was definitely my hands was part of it. Another part of it, I think, was that I think I got last minute kind of like panic, and I was like, oh shit, we're about to go in the studio and do this incredibly hard music.
Yeah.
All live in the studio, right. All in the same room, no overdubs. We've got to be able to do it. And I could talk about that in a minute because it was actually kind of like really interesting. And I just thought, do I want the added complexity of, and I'm playing a fretless and just making sure I'm in tune and stuff like that, do I want that added kind of just that stress? And I think that coupled with my hands going a bit weird and all of that, and I was just like, fuck it, I'm just going to do it on the fret. And I'm glad part of me is really glad that I did it all on the fret. I really enjoyed playing it, like I really did. It would have been nice to do a couple of tracks on the fretless, but I think that there's only a small part of me that wishes I'd done some stuff on the fretless. Mm-hmm. I actually really enjoy playing the fretted on it as well, and I do love this bass. Like I really love it. And before,
I love that you love it. It's like your bass now.
Yeah, and I really was sort of like I was figuring out specific sounds before I went in the studio, and it was kind of like a really different experience from practicing at home. So like from a tonal perspective, I put these knobs on here, sort of with markers. They had these small black knobs on. But I couldn't see what was going on. And on the fly, I really needed to understand sort of like, have I got the neck pickup full up, or is it like backed off a little bit, or what's going on the fly? I need to know. I can't be sort of like fiddling with knobs in the middle of a track.
Right.
So I swapped these knobs out so they've got markers on. I kind of like the look of them as well.
It looks pretty cool.
Yeah. And then for most of the album, I played with the bridge pickup on all the way up and the neck pickup on about 80%. I actually dialed back the neck pickup a lot. So on some of it I played with it all the way up, some of it I played with it all the way off, but most of it I played with the neck pickup on about 80%. Tone, let me get this right, I think the tone was about 50% on, treble, middle and bass 100% up, everything. And you can't do that. Yeah, you can't do that on all basses. If you did that on a Sadowski, it'd just sound ridiculous. But on the F bass, the circuit's actually really subtle, so I could put everything on full.
Rich
Brown does the same thing, everything on full. I think he has treble on zero, but I preferred treble on full and backing off the tone. It was kind of cool experimenting between what did I like prefer the sound of, like backing off the treble or backing off the tone. That was interesting.
Real quick, if you do, I'm just seeing it in my mind. If there is an SD SIG, the F bass SD SIG, I want a circuit where everything is up, but you can't, like, it's on and you only have three knobs. So it looks like a passive setup.
So it looks
right?
Like
so
that.
You've got volume, pickup, blend, and tone. Right?
Yeah.
But then everything is full up, but that's just on like trim pots inside the control cavity.
Yeah.
And that'd be badass, dude.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like, I was talking to Marcel about that kind of thing, actually. Yeah, I was talking about, like, before, like, a few months ago. So that's what we did with the, that's what I did with the bass. And then, and then the cabs, I just was, like, into the trick fish. And then we did Mike the Cab. And DI straight out the back of the trick fish. Actually, I had a what's one of the DIs with the big control right in the middle that are really popular?
Avalon.
So we did a bunch of tests actually with the Avalon. We all preferred it straight out the back of the trick fish. Who knew?
Hell yeah.
Yeah. So like
hell yeah, yeah. Justin and Ryan, if you're listening, trick fish beats the Avalon. That is so cool. Very cool. Yeah, those guys are amazing. Those guys
are amazing. Yeah, they are. Justin's awesome, isn't he?
I happen to know this too, Scott, real quick, that Ryan Owens from Trickfish got one of the IMA bases.
Did he?
Yeah. Oh,
amazing. Amazing.
Yeah, so cool.
I love the Trickfish guys. They're cool.
Very cool. Awesome. Okay, sorry. Keep going.
No, all good, man. And so that's what I did bass-wise and gear-wise. I had sort of like a huge pedal board that was all set up with all of these different things on it. And the Friday that I decided to use the banana bass, I was like, okay, I'm taking the fretted. I'm just going to play one bass. I looked at that pedal board and I was like, I'm stripping everything off it. Amazing. I stripped everything off it. So I had a volume pedal, I had a tuner, and I used a reverb pedal. And that was it.
Amazing.
And I had all of the preamps on and all of the gubbins and I had the compressor and everything on there. I stripped it all off. I was like, just get out of my way. I just need to play great. So,
good for you. Wow. Yeah,
so that was really interesting going through that. And then in the studio, it was so interesting actually because we had it, we were in the studio for 5 days. But Monday was just set up. We were doing 9 tracks, so we were recording for 4 days. The band was myself, Simon King playing guitar, Scott Kinsey on keys. Scott Kinsey, like Scott Kinsey. If anybody doesn't know who Scott Kinsey is, he's like he was the keys player in Tribal Tech. He was like one of the greatest fusion keys players of all time. So Scott Kinsey, Gergo Borlai on drums, obviously Freak Show in all of the greatest ways, Nate Worth from Snarky Puppy on percussion, and we had David Binney, who is like, a Freak Show, again, in all of the greatest ways on sax. And we tracked for 4 days, 9 tunes, recorded it all live in the room, and they were brutal tunes.
Yes.
We'd never played together before. People got the tracks ahead of time so they could listen to them.
Thank God.
But in the studio, it was really interesting, man, because we didn't have time really to rehearse. So what we did is we ran through each track around 2 times. So what we'd do is we had an order. So we figured out what order we were going to record the tunes in.
Yes.
And we'd mapped out what days we were going to record them. So the Tuesday, we were going to record 3 tunes. Then the Wednesday, 2. Thursday, 2. Friday, 2. That would be the 9 tunes complete.
Dang.
So on the Tuesday... So, and each tune, we racked up, we got out the charts and stuff like that. We reviewed it as a group, and we're like, okay, let's run through 1 or 2 times to get a feel for the track.
Yes.
So we just like run them through 1 or 2 times to get a feel for the track. And when I say that these are really complex tracks, I'm just going to reiterate, these are really complex tracks.
Yeah.
These are like lots of hairy time signatures, solos.
Yes.
Freaking gnarly. Yeah.
Like if anybody out there has ever checked out Player's Path on SBL and like checked out Level 9, for instance, it's akin to some of that intense, like polyrhythmic, odd time signature, wild melodic phrases. Like it's heavy jazz fusion that you can't just be like, oh, I think I'm going to just pick up and jam along to this. It's like very through composed. I'm sure there's solos, but like all the heads and stuff are very like through composed. And I mean, I got the pleasure of hearing some of it before you went in, and I can attest, like I just throw my hands up in the air and I'd say, is there a bass player in the house? Because it sure as hell ain't going to be me.
Oh, it's great.
So I'm
man.
Glad it was you, Divine.
It's pretty great.
Okay.
Just if anybody's wondering as well, the entire album is going to be level 10 on Player's Path.
Oh, sick.
So when we release the album, you're going to be able to listen to the album. Then we're going to give you all of the backing tracks so you can play along with that band. And we're going to give you all of the lead sheets. And I'm going to teach you how to play all of the tracks. It's level 10 of Player's Path. So if you are a member, good things on the way.
Oh, that's so fun, dude. Yeah, that's so cool.
I'm really excited about it.
Yes.
So we got in. So on the Tuesday, so what we did for each of the tracks, we ran through one or two times, just sort of like top to bottom, got a vibe for the feel, and then we would doing a take.
Yeah. Right?
Then it was into the takes. On average, I would say that we did two takes of each track, and maybe like maximum three, maybe four on one of them, but in general, like two takes. So
that's incredible.
And if anybody's wondering, like, why did you only do two takes? And it's because we're tracking live in the room. Everybody's live in the room.
Yes.
So it's not and to add, they're all monsters. Like, they're all freaking monster players. So you cannot get to the end of a take and be like, oh, sorry, guys. I screwed up that section. Can we do it again?
And like, because everybody has to.
Yeah. And like Dave Binney or Scott Kinsey's just blazed out an awesome solo. They are like, in their mind, they might not say it out loud, but in their mind, they're like, are you freaking kidding me?
Right. Right.
So the pressure was high. Let me just put it that way, dude. High pressure.
I bet.
You put that scenario, and then also, they're all monster players, and they're all jet-lagged to shit.
Oh, God. Right? Kind of grumpy.
You do not want to be the person that's like going, hey, oh, let's do that take again.
Well, let me ask you this, though.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this, because everybody's going to want to know. It could, as a bass player, who you're in the room, but you're tracking DI, if there's something that you goofed up and you got, shit, that was great, except that one spot I really need, you know, I need to play an A instead of the G, could you punch? And were there moments that everyone had the opportunity to punch?
Let me think through this.
Or was it like warts and all? Because no one is playing a perfect performance.
Mostly warts and all. We could grab like a section from like... and move it. Say so.
Because you're
like
on click.
If I played the same phrase somewhere else, I could grab that and move it. So we did that for sure. Not for everybody. Sax was very difficult because because he's in the room, he's got a mic, and all of the band are going down David's mic.
Yeah.
Incredibly difficult.
So sax is in the drum mics, right?
Exactly.
Like sax is everywhere.
Sax is everywhere, drums is everywhere. So it was a bit of a monster. It was super high pressure. It was definitely high pressure. Like I felt that high pressure. It was interesting because it made me think about what it must be like to be sort of like a full-on studio musician back in the day when they were sort of like just pumping out them tracks and they just had to nail it. There was no kind of like, oh, let's do a second, let's do a third take, or let's do a fourth take. Oh, like you're not going to get booked again if you do that. So I think that what interestingly happened to me in that room was that I had to really get comfortable with where like 85 to 90%, maybe like 85% of my capability was, because I can't go to 100%. Because if I'm 100% of my capability and dangling myself over the cliff, I might fall off.
Right.
And then I'm going to stick my arm in the air and say, sorry, guys, I screwed up. Let's start again.
Yes.
Oh, and you don't want to be that guy, right?
No,
So you have to... And I think that everybody's in the same boat. In that sort of like everybody's in the room playing that music, nobody's playing to 100% of their capability.
Of course. Yeah, everybody's, I was going to say, like, no one.
80-85%, yeah.
Everybody's, because everybody's got to be cognizant of the room, and they can't just be taking these giant risks and then be like, oh, sorry guys, I was really going for it there and it was terrible. So
so that was interesting, trying to find out where that was for me, because there was like solos and stuff like that, like I'm playing melodies and I'm playing, so like the first track that we did was the first solo was a bass solo. I was like, oh god. Jeez. I was like, yeah, like I was hoping, like, hey, let's do a bass solo maybe like day three. But it was the first tune, first solo was bass
solo. How are the solos? How did the solos turn out for you? Like, if you can just speak to you, How, because I'm sure the sax solos were great. I know Psy probably crushed it. But how were your solos? How did you feel about it?
I found it harder than I thought I would. From a technique standpoint, I definitely wasn't as fluid as I can be. And I think that depends day by day on what, you know what it's like. Some days you're just sort of like, it's happening. Some days it's not. On the first day, it just wasn't happening. I felt sort of like, which was shit, because obviously I have to live with that solo. It is what it is, you know?
Sure.
And yeah, and I kind of sort of like, I committed to that as well. Like Matt, the engineer, he was like, well, at the end of the week, he was like, you know, with the solos and stuff, Scott, he was like, we could sort of like get other parts of solos and sort of like, you can choose, like if we've done three takes of a solo, we could just sort of like lift the entire section of the band and sort of like, yeah, like move the sort of like, so a solo is made up of like three solos basically. Yeah. And I was like, no. I was like, I want to commit to what was recorded at the time because I wanted that essence. I wanted to, I just wanted to be able to sort of like, you know,
I did that
in the moment. I didn't, that isn't sort of like me editing three solos together.
Right.
That is what I played in that moment. No bullshit. Like, and that was not for anybody else. That was a personal thing for me. So, I was happy that from a technique standpoint, I didn't feel as fluid as I am, especially on the first 2 days was sort of like trickier because I was having to play with two gloves on. So that was a new kind of new experience. But then towards the end of the week, I did feel like my technique sort of like loosened up and stuff. And I did some sort of like cool solos. Like there's a cool solo where they call Hypersphere, where the whole first like 2 or 3 minutes of there's no melody on. There's like two solos. It's just there's three solos, and the entire song is just a chord sequence. So cool. It's just it starts and it's straight into the bass solo. Then there's a sax solo, and then there's a key solo, and then it's the end. And it's like a ballad. And I did I did a really great job of that. So I did the job I did of that solo. I was really happy with it. I thought that's it was amazing. Really cool. Yeah, it was really cool.
Oh, I can't wait to hear it, dude.
There was some freaking awesome, like. It's easier for me to talk about the other solos on the album. Let me just play the sax solo. Like this is unmixed. This is unmixed. So take it for what it is. But where are we? Yes. Yeah, so this is totally unmixed. But we were doing this track, and David, the sax player, was like a. Let's put distortion on the sax and some delay.
Oh, cool.
I was like, oh yeah, let's absolutely do that.
Yeah, cool.
So which one was it? Was it this one? Let me see. Holy crap. Anyway, let's see if the
dude, this music is my nightmare.
People definitely have nightmares to this music.
If I were asked to play, like, seriously, I would have a panic attack. If, like, oh, go on stage and just, you know, with these guys, I would have a panic attack.
Dude, it was like a dare gone wrong. Simon and I definitely had a few texts go back and forward, like, a few days before. Was just like, did we make a really bad decision somewhere along the line here? And like, it was the realization of like, oh shit. Yeah. Like at one point, I think after the first or second, I think it was after the first day, Simon just came over and he was like, shit, dude. He was like, this is like running the 100-meter race next to Usain Bolt.
Yes, yes.
It was just sort of like, dude, bonkers. But check out this sax solo.
Right.
This is awesome. It's like jazz metal, isn't it?
Yes, I love the rhythm behind it.
But this rhythm was a bitch. This ain't Dave Sanborn.
Oh, Scott, this is cool, dude. Oh, Gergo just building it up.
Yeah.
Was that just wild to be a part of in the room? Like, it's just like the floor just like levitating. Wow, man.
Wild. Now, just off the back of that, just to make my point, what was earlier, can you imagine getting to the end of that take and be like, sorry, guys.
Dude, exactly.
Like, it just can't happen. It was just sort of like, yeah. No, yeah.
It's just like, sorry. If you missed one of the syncopations in it, tough. Tough noogies, Divine, yeah, right? Yeah. It's like, yeah, oh my God, man.
It was wild, yeah. It was wild. It was sort of like, we listened to that, like the night after. Oh, it was just so good listening to that after we'd done it. Like, not when all the guys were there, because like when the guys are there, it's like a whole thing. And like, you know,
yeah.
It's more you're like, you're checking out. You can't listen to it sort of like as a listener.
You can't enjoy it.
You can't enjoy it. You're like in the control room. You listen to every little thing, and you're like, "Is this
scrutinizing?"
It? Is
this
yeah, it's scrutinizing it. But that night, we got back to sort of like the accommodation, cracked open a cider, we put that thing on, and I was like, "Holy shit!" I was like, "That was great. That was really great." Yeah. So that's, I was like, so cool. Super chuffed with that. Yeah.
Will there be a show?
I don't know. Like, we maybe. Yeah. Like, I. Like, it would be great to do that. It would be great to do that. It'd be great to do, like, three shows.
Yes.
I'd love to do, like, the baked potato in LA. Like, there's a couple of things that I'd like to just tick off the bucket list, you know? Just, like, done.
You guys have to do a show. I think you have to do, like a record release. Or just a commemorative show. I don't know. You know, a digital. Maybe it's not a record. You know, like a download release show.
Yeah, maybe like a live. Well, we could video it or something like that as well. It'd be cool.
Yes.
But, yeah. So it'd be great to do something like that. Like what we are definitely going to do, just for anybody that's wondering, is we're going to. All the nine tracks, we recorded them and we filmed them as well, obviously. They're all going to go on YouTube. We're going to release them over a 9-week period. So we're going to release the album on Spotify and iTunes on week zero. And then on week one, we're going to start uploading them onto YouTube one a week. We're also going to have like a live listening party. We're going to do sort of like, I thought it'd be cool to get Simon on the podcast as well.
Oh, yeah.
So we can talk to him. That'd be really cool to do. And then we also thought at the end of the 9 weeks of rolling all of the tracks out, it'd be really cool to do a competition where we get people to choose a track themselves, and then they can play it, video themselves doing it, and then we'll do a whole competition with winners and runners up and stuff like that, and whoever wins we'll get them a banana base built or something, like one of the banana bases built.
Wow.
something cool,
whoa,
really cool,
really,
yeah.
Oh, that's so exciting. I gotta get in the shed, dude, and the winner is Ian. No, I don't think I can play that music.
You don't, like, honestly,
wow.
Just between me and you, you don't want to try and play this music. It's just sort of like a dare gone wrong. It was a dare.
Oh, my God.
I was
God.
So happy on Monday. I said to Lisa on Monday. Yeah. I was like, Lisa, I'm so happy that I've just done it. I'm finished and I don't need to practice that stuff anymore. Because, like, it was a piece of work trying to get ready for that thing. And
it was
kind of like our YouTube stuff. I think that I didn't over-prepare. I over-worried about it. I didn't need to do that. You know, I did over-worry about it, and I over-prepared to a certain degree. Under-prepared in many ways as well. I think that doing it all again, I would be just, like, less stressed about it. Less... Not that I was, like, crazy stressed. Like, you know me, I'm not sort of, like, crazy stressed about anything, but...
Yeah, right.
I got... You know, I was sort of, like, thinking about it a couple of weeks coming up to it. I'll tell you, I'm not sure that I... An interesting thing happened that Friday... That I will talk about, which I haven't talked to you about actually.
Please.
And it's never happened to me before. Because I'm like really, what's the word? I'm a prepper, right? Not for not for war or zombie destruction or anything like that, but for I prepare generally like really well for gigs and sessions and stuff like that. And I was like practicing a lot for this coming up to it. And then in my mind, I'd scheduled out like Friday, I'm going to practice. Saturday, I'm going to practice.
Yes.
Sunday, I'm going to practice. Just doing that final cram.
And all the way
Monday,
up to it.
I'm into the studio, right? Well, Friday came. And I picked up my bass and I was like, oh, my hands felt a bit weird. And I was like, oh, I'm just going to use the yellow bass. I played through half a track. And then this is so odd. It was like, my conscious brain was like, yeah, you've told Lisa and the kids you're not going to be around this weekend. You're practicing all weekend, getting ready. And something subconscious was like, actually, no. No more. Put everything away in the case and don't look at it again. And that's what I did. Amazing. That Friday morning, I put my bass away in the case. I put all of... And I just packed everything down.
Yep.
Like, literally, I couldn't even practice because there was no amp. Everything was packed down.
Yeah.
And I said to Lisa, I was like, oh, this weird thing happened. I was like, some kind of, like, subconscious thing came in somewhere in my mind. It was just like, that's enough. You ain't going to do any more. Stop worrying about it. And I didn't even think about it. It was actually kind of cool.
That's great.
Yeah. It was like some sort of like, it was like my subconscious was protecting myself. You know, it was cool to experience that.
And you're probably, your hands needed a break. Your brain needed a break. Everything just needed a break. I mean, that's like Obi-Wan, dude. It's like, use the Force, Scott. You know what I mean? Like, let's just trust in yourself that you've put in the work. That, you know, that your skill that you've been working your whole life to achieve will do the rest. Yeah. It's not going to be perfect, but it's going to be great. Put the bass away, hang with the family. That's very
exactly cool. Yeah. And what has happened is I'm really, really freaking pumped to do like another one. I'm like, let's go. Oh, yeah. Because I haven't done this because of my hands. I didn't know I could do it.
I didn't know I could do it.
I've not recorded any music for 15 years or long.
Wow.
I mean, like, nothing. Yes. Like, I've wanted to do a solo project for years.
Right, of course.
And just didn't. Every time I thought about it, I was just like, I can't do it because it's too much. It's too dangerous. Too much for my hands.
Too stressful. I cannot do it. Yeah.
Too stressful for my hands, yeah.
Yes.
And I did it. And I was like, oh, I actually did the thing. And like, it did. My hands did go funny on day three, actually. I had a weird thing where my ring finger on this hand was not working. It was like maybe sort of like working. It's sort of like maybe 60% of its capability or something like that. So I was having to like maneuver around one of my fingers not working very well, which was a bit...
Wow.
It was tricky. But at least it was my ring finger and it wasn't my index finger, my little finger. That's right. When it happens to my index finger, when it happens to the rock fingers, that is a bitch.
It's a bitch.
Sure. Yeah. It's a bitch. So there was that one day where it went a bit weird. And it definitely, like... It, you know, weird things are happening to my hands during the week and it was progressively getting... more complex, but they didn't collapse. And what it proved to me is, oh, if I want to do a project that's going to last about a week, you can actually do it. You can
that's
do
amazing.
It. I can repeat that formula again. So yes, I'm sort of like, ooh, what's the next thing? Yeah. I'm like,
but dude, that's so cool. Yeah. It's like tested your limits on some of the heaviest stuff with some of the heaviest cats, and you prevail. Yeah. And like, dude, badass. Congratulations, dude.
Yeah. Oh man, thank you. And it was amazing playing with them that band as well. Oh, like, holy,
I can't even imagine.
Shit, they're so good.
I had such FOMO. Like, I've said this to you before, but I just wanted to be in there tuning up your bass, bringing the dude some coffee. Like, anybody need anything? Man, I just would have loved to have seen that. But I'm so happy that you guys got it all captured. Nick and Dan were there, right? Recording.
Yeah, well, Nick wasn't there. He was there the first and the last day. Yeah, we actually, like, in hindsight, we should have had somebody there to be a runner on during the day, but we didn't during the day. So that ended up, that was me. So I was like running around making sure everybody had water and shit like that, and going to the shop and buying water and, like, you know,
hey, next time you call old Allison,
absolutely,
we'll get in there, man. I'll get in there.
I was like, damn, I was like, he was right. I should have had him over here doing this, but
man,
yeah.
you need that. You need somebody that's taking care of that stuff, because it sucks to have to be the guy to be like, okay, well, now I guess I'll go out and get everybody sandwiches.
Ugh, yeah. Sucks. And also, like, it would have actually helped, I think, for sort of like for the vibe as well. Like, the vibe was quite interesting. They were all, like, real introverts. Like, and it's something I never even contemplated. Like, oh, yeah, we're booking this band. They were all super introverted.
Wow.
So, like, yeah, like, Gergo, super quiet. Scott Kinsey, super quiet. You know, like beautiful guy, like, lovely guys, but just naturally very quiet. So it was sort of like, I'm like a kid, you know, I'm like... And Simon wasn't used to it, actually. Simon was like, oh, the vibe's a little weird. And I was like, yeah, I was like, dude, it's just, they're super quiet. And he was like, I think that, like, I've been in those situations before where people are just sort of like super quiet. But if you haven't been in that situation, it can sort of like, it can throw you under the loop sometimes.
Yeah, it starts to go internal where you're like, what's wrong? Do they not like the music? Do they not like me? Like, that's what I do. I start to bring it to my, make it about me. Get all self-conscious about it, you know? You needed somebody to like bust through and be like, that was amazing, you guys! Or like, you know.
So like Simon definitely felt a little bit self-conscious, I think, at times, because he was like, oh God, they're so quiet, you know? And they are quiet.
They're his tunes,
They were his tunes. So I think it was definitely hard. There was a moment, maybe on day three or something like that, or maybe day two, and I really felt for him, actually. He was sort of like, you could see the weight. The weight was on his shoulders. It was hard for Simon. I'll tell you what, it was hard. Because he had a lot of on his shoulders. Because, like, he was like, he wrote these pieces.
Yes.
Right? So he's like MD-ing.
Right.
These guys. And that's like, he's not only trying to freaking do his parts and play them, which are a complete bitch, but he's also having to sort of like, you know, David can't get a sax melody down. Simon's having to help him through that and point out, no, like this note, just hold that note on for a little longer, blah, 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 blah. And then sort of like, oh yeah. So it was like, I think it was maybe on the second or third day, I looked over and I was like, I could feel the, weight on him. Yeah, if we could feel that weight, and I was like, I felt sorry. So I did. We sort of like had a conversation that night, and I was like, look, man, I was like, this is all good. This is just sort of like, this is the vibe. That's their vibe. It's fine. Do you know what I mean? It's not about you. There's no there's no weird vibes on here. You know, just let's sort of like, you know, let's get cooking and sort of like just do a great job of what we're here to do. And it was cool. Like, it did end up really cool. So it was it was good, man. I enjoyed it.
Do you? I'm not going to ask you about any specific people. We don't have to name names. I have had an experience in the studio, though, where I was working with a famous drummer, and the famous drummer was not getting the thing right. And the producer was looking at me, because I'm in the room with the famous drummer, and the producer is looking at me with these huge eyes, like, help me. Because he had tried to get the famous drummer to do the thing right.
Yeah.
And then he was like, help. I mean, I think he literally mouthed to me. And I was like, hey, man, you know, now I'm going to try to grease the wheel and be like diplomatic and try to. And it was really difficult. It was really difficult. And I remember giving some references, and the famous drummer was like, I hate those bands. And I was like, you know, sometimes there's like a little bit of ego, especially when a monster, you know, a monster player can't get something right.
Yeah.
It's not necessarily about, oh, they don't like the song, or they get grumpy because they are feeling exposed. And that's at least what I felt like in the scenario that I was in, was that, you know, this guy was getting exposed. He couldn't play this beat. And instead of being like, guys, give me 5 minutes with this, he was like, that reference sucks. I don't like that. I'm not saying that anybody did that. I'm just saying I've had that experience. And that's tough.
Yeah, so what we did in those scenarios, or I did, so there was like certain things where I'd be listening and maybe sort of like some hits weren't getting like happening or anything like something like that. I would ask a question that I knew the answer to.
Yes.
Okay, so I'd ask a question that I knew the answer to, just to make it obvious that we're supposed to be doing this thing. So, for instance, let's say one of the band are not getting the hits in the right place, something like that, or they're not making the hits. They're playing through. Okay. I'd do something like this. I'd like, hey, Simon, I was like, do you know these hits right there? I was like, are we all supposed, like, do you want me to catch them? And like, is everybody catching these hits right here? Simon's like, oh, yeah. Yeah, everybody catches them hits. And then anybody that hasn't been catching them hits in the room, they're like, oh, shit, I need to catch them hits.
Yes.
You know, so
but you're
kind
not
of
outing
sort of like,
somebody.
Yeah, you take it on the chin. You almost out yourself you do that sort of like thing. So that's, or there's another way of doing it. So another way is, hey, let's just, can we just sort of like play that section around and round? Because I'm just sort of like trying to get these hits down. I'm just sort of like,
One more time for me.
Yeah, exactly that. I just want to make sure I'm locking in with everybody else. Yeah, so you make it about you and not everybody. You know the score, dude.
Of course I do, yes. Yeah, but that's brilliant. Yeah. I mean, that's brilliant, like, you know, diplomacy. That's brilliant, like, ego at the door. And because you're in charge of that vibe, right? It's your project. Even, you know, Cy wrote the tunes of his project, but it's your project too. So yeah, you have to be the one that's like, oh yeah, let's run it around a few times for me.
Yeah,
but it's not for you. Yeah,
it's not
right.
For me, yeah,
that's great.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of other sort of like, I did. I think that, you know, like, I'll do a bunch of stuff like that. Like, hey, let's just do it. Can we just do that ending again? Just because I want to make sure that I'm getting in the right spot.
It's great. Yeah, man. Well, and it's nice because it gives everyone an opportunity to, like, you know, if someone is uncomfortable to say, ah, it was on me, you know, like, you cover for them, which is very, very nice.
Yeah.
So that's being a producer in the room, man. That's hard to do. It's juggling a bunch of different roles. That's difficult. You're the bass player, right? And you're also acting as producer. You're also acting as probably camp counselor in a way, too. Yeah, you know what I mean?
Yeah. I think me and Sam were doing that. And then I think that also as well, like, there was definitely times where either Simon and I, or sometimes the band as well, were like, but not everybody. Some people were like happy with that take, and we were like, "Let's do it again. Come on, let's do it again." The energy wasn't right. It's not. It sounds messy. It's not locked in yet, right?
Yes.
So, and then, you know, in those circumstances, you just got to be like, "There's actually sort of like, that's not the time to be diplomatic. That's the time to be just sort of like, okay, let's do it again."
Yep.
Yeah, because you can't be diplomatic all the time.
How would everyone feel about just taking one more run at it? Not that.
Yeah, it's not that vibe. No, it's not that. Yeah. It's like, come on, let's do it again. Yeah. So, but it was really interesting. And all of the, what I really loved as well is that all of the, like, and I assumed it would be like this, but Dan, shout out to Dan, who's there doing all of the video stuff, and Louis and Ross as well, who were doing video stuff. But Dan thought they were going to turn up and they were going to be like more, it was going to be more like a session musician type of vibe. Mm. They were going to turn up, play the parts, that was that. Mm. And it was not like that. They actually were like this intro, like, can we make that a different vibe? Like, it's not really working for me, that vibe. Like, what can we do with that? And then we'd discuss it, we'd have some ideas and stuff, and we'd do something. And then somebody might hear a section and be like, oh, let's bring it right down there and let's build it. So Dan at the end of the days, he was like, dude, this is like a freaking, like a real band. What do you mean? And he was like, I just didn't expect it. He just said, I expected them to just play the parts, you guys to do your thing, and that was it. And he was like, well, you guys, this is like a real band. And I was like, yeah, I guess so. And I kind of expected that, but it was interesting to know that he didn't expect that. And I'm sure
he just thought they were
going to
come in, like fighter pilots, like, yes, sir, and like execute the parts, shoot down the enemy planes, and then return to base.
Yeah,
but instead instead it was more of a collaboration. How did Simon do? He might listen to this. I don't know, but like, what was it difficult for you guys, I should say this, for both of you to let go of some of the demo stuff, or was it really hard to let go of some of it?
I don't think it was hard. I think there was one track that was sort of like, it was like a like out and out Latin kind of thing.
Yeah.
And And Nate, the percussion player, really, really didn't want to do sort of like a pseudo Latin. He was like, I don't want to do a Latin. Like, he was like, it can sound, it can be influenced by that. But he was like, I don't just don't want to do like a crap white version of Latin, right? He was like, yeah, it cannot be that. So that was, and actually, like, Nate was not quiet. So Nate's actually sort of like a 6'6" big dude from Chicago, yeah, like really sort of like outspoken, very sort of like type A character. So he was, I would say, like, possibly a little heavy handed with his delivery, even though the sentiment was bang on. I think the sentiment was great, but like a little heavy handed. And I think in the moment, in the studio, it was, I think, because it's Simon's, you know, Simon's written these tunes, you know, I think it was hard, that was a hard moment for Simon. He was like, whoa. Yeah. And I think it could have been totally sidestepped if it was just delivered maybe in a little bit of a, in a sort of like more courteous way.
Oh, delivery, man. I mean, delivery really matters, you know?
Yeah. But, you know, like, I'm not sort of like, no shade against Nate. He said what he said. And I think that, you know, more power to him for saying it, for saying confident enough to say it, sure, stuff like that. I think that he just sort of like, yeah.
Do you feel like it ended up getting better? Do you feel like the result was better as a result of the feedback?
Yes, I think it was great. And also Gergo and Scott Kinsey and Dave all agreed, but they would have done it in a different way. Right. I think that, yeah, it would have been in a softer way. So, yeah, all of the pressure and that at the same time, that messaging at the same time was sort of like slightly, it was slightly rough. It was tough, oh, man. Yeah, it was freaking awesome. And, you know, and I was super stoked at the end of the week. Simon was super stoked. He loved it. I think he had a great experience playing his socks off. That guy's a freak show.
Oh, like, he's a really freak show.
You know, he's, yes, he played at SG. Like, he's playing SG Fusion. I love it, you know.
Oh, it's
like,
so cool.
Yeah. I just want to sort of like Photoshop some sort of like English schoolboy attire onto him so he looks like Angus Young from AC/DC playing freaking Metal Fusion.
Oh, it's great. Yeah, dude. Yeah, oh, yeah, man.
It was awesome, though. Dude, we better wrap it. What time are we on? Yeah, let's wrap it, dude. We're...
Thank you.
Like 1 hour 20 into it.
Dude, thanks for telling me all about that. And thanks for asking about the bass. Good times, man. Good times in bass world. I can't wait to hear the record. I know a lot of people feel the same.
I can't wait to get it out. It's going to be a blast. It's going to be a blast. Awesome. I can't wait to see it. I can't wait to hear it because the mix is so bad. Yeah, I mean, like, it's like unmixed at the minute. So when I listen to it, you know, there's barely any bass. I'm like, oh, I wish I could hear some bass. You know, it's sort of like,
yeah.
It's sort of like way down in the mix.
Wow.
So yeah, it's going to be, it's going to be great to hear it. The guy called George. Let me see. I don't know if I've got his surname.
George
is mixing it. Let me have a look. He just watched that.
Mixing engineer.
Yeah, he's supposed to be it. George Perks. Yeah, he's supposed to be a badass.
Awesome.
Yeah. So, let's see. Let's see what he can do. Hopefully he kills it. Anyway, dude, let's bounce. Thank you so much for listening. If anybody's listening, anybody wanted to know the release date of the album and stuff like that, I have no freaking clue. I think that in my mind, I've been sort of like 8 weeks, maybe, you know, but maybe like 8 to 10 weeks, maybe something like that. That seems doable, you know, but we'll wait and see.
Amazing.
Yeah, and thanks for sharing all that stuff for the signature bass, man.
Hey, don't you dare call it a sig. If anybody's interested in an IMA4, I think we are going to do another run to give more people chances late summer, early fall this year.
Beautiful. Awesome, dude. Cool. I'll see you in a bit, guys. Take it easy. Bye.
Take care, everybody.